Further ado, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce our visiting colleague, Dr. Varoufakis, who is, as you know, originally from Greece. He was educated in Britain, and that is where he started his academic career in various universities across Great Britain, Europe, Australia, and then back to his native Greece. If you saw in the description of the colloquium that I sent around, he has an amazing production in his CV. He really is an incredibly productive scholar, has written several books, and we were teasing him, Jeremy and I, just a moment ago about the title of one of his books, which is A Modest Proposal to Solve the Euro Crisis. And one of his co-authors on this book is Jamie Galbraith. So there's a third co-author, and I was saying, who's the modest? Where's the modest here? So anyway, we're delighted to have him. I know for many of you, I know in particular for our PhD students, game theory is a big deal. I'm delighted that so many of our master's students are here as well. We are really pleased to have you here at the school, but also to speak from your discovery of game theory and your wrestling with game theory starting as a graduate student. So,
well, thank you very much, Gloria. Thank you, everyone, for being here. It's a great privilege, pleasure, honor to be addressing PhD students in particular, because I am an accidental economist. And I became an accidental economist at this stage where you find yourself. That is, when I was beginning the transition from my master's thesis to my PhD. I was a student of mathematics. I had toyed with the idea of becoming an economist when I was a first year undergraduate student. Three or four lectures in microeconomics convinced me it's not for me, that it was second-rate mathematics, so why not study first-rate mathematics instead? Which I did, hoping that, you know, I had escaped the clutches of economics forever. And especially when I finished my master's in mathematics, I thought that was it, a life free of economics. Until my supervisor asked me to find a dissertation topic, and he gave me two or three suggestions. One was quality control of jet engines working for the RAF in Britain. Another one was traffic systems and applications of queuing theory to the design of traffic signals. So on and so forth. I was not enthused by this idea, so I spent a few days wandering around the University of Birmingham's wonderful library and reading anything randomly, you know, something that we don't do these days with search engines and all that. And it was late at night, it was a Tuesday night, it was minus 10 degrees centigrade, whatever that is in Fahrenheit, and I came across a copy of the American Economic Review, 1976, a guy from MIT had written a very mathematical paper on industrial conflict in the United States. Negotiations between firms, large corporations, and trade unions. So he began with a very sophisticated atypically sophisticated mathematical model of bargaining between employers and trade unions, which then became a highly sophisticated econometrics model, much more sophisticated than anything else that I've seen in econometrics ever since. So in that sense, it was a very interesting paper. And so I read it. I sat down on the floor and I read it, because it was fascinating that somebody had the audacity to claim that, you know, by means of a mathematical model, you can capture the nuances of bargaining, and then you can actually end up with a fascinating statement. The empirics in this paper proved, beyond doubt, that the theoretical result in section 2 of the paper is supported by the data, and therefore the conclusion of this paper is that employers act rationally, and trade unions resist mechanistically. So I thought, to what extent is this conclusion truly supported by the mathematics and the statistics? So that was, I never thought I was going to write a thesis on that, but for some reason, the next day, I wrote to Hank Farber, was his name, Professor Farber from MIT, an economist, and asked him for his data. And I was never expecting to get it. But back then, it wasn't just an email, yeah, right? I ended up with a magnetic tape that big in the mail, which was exceptionally nice of him. And I hope that you have such similar encounters with generous academics when you try to debunk what they're doing. So three cheers to Hank Farber of the MIT. Still around. Once I had that magnetic tape, I was imprisoned. I had to work on it. I had to look at the data, to rework the mathematics, to program the computer to see if I can replicate what he had done. And the rest is history. Now, the thing about that particular model, that ended up being my PhD thesis in the end. Because what I thought I discovered was fundamental philosophical flaws in the way that the mathematical models and the statistical methods were being utilized in order to produce conclusions. And I thought that that would be just my master's dissertation. But once I wrote it, my supervisor sent it to a professor at the London School of Economics, who said, well, this is a PhD thesis. So I was sucked into writing a PhD on that. And then one or two months later, I published a couple of papers on the topic of our today's presentation, which was a natural extension, I'll explain why. And suddenly I had job offers from economics departments. And I had to learn economics by teaching it, which is actually the best way of learning anything, right? Now, but let me talk to you very briefly about how I got lured into game theory. The paper that I mentioned by Hank Farber has no game theory in it. It was a very static model, optimization model. The firm maximizes intertemporal profit functions subject to constraints posed by the unions. The unions were acting mechanistically, that was the theory, and that produced a mathematical model of wages, strike duration, expected strike duration, and all that. And then he had data from individual negotiations. These data was actually very high quality data. It was not simply taken from some database. He actually did the real work, footwork of creating his own data set. And then he showed that his data was consistent with his mathematical model using maximum likelihood estimation, very complicated numerical techniques, and so on and so forth. But everybody was passive in this kind of theory. The bosses were passive. The trade unions were passive. There were no real negotiations. It was just the CEO of the company selecting a combination of wage rises and strike durations that were optimal for the firm intertemporally. And there was absolutely no give and take. The whole point about bargaining was absent from it. So I remember I was criticizing economists for reducing bargaining to a static snapshot of a single choice. And at some point, I heard very quickly one of my colleagues saying, yes, but you're ignoring game theory. Because game theory is the next step. It is a step that economists take when they want to model the actual bargaining process and strategic interaction. As in chess, where your move depends on what you think that your opponent will interpret your move as, so what you're going to do depends on what you think he's going to think that you think that he's going to think at infinitum, or 50 moves ahead if you're a good player. Similarly, in negotiations, every move that President Obama is making now these days depends on what he thinks that the other side will think that he thinks that they will think, and so on and so forth. And I was a 20-something-year-old graduate student. The idea that there is a mathematical way of getting to the bottom of this and cutting this Gordian knot of what I believe that you believe that I believe that you believe was fascinating. And I thought, they claim that they've done it. Let's see whether they have. So that started me on a 20-year path, which I want to convey to you. This is not a standard academic seminar. This is addressing PhD students who are struggling to imagine a process whereby they're going to stand on the shoulders of giants and reach for the skies. Now, I have to say that my tale does not concur with this romantic view. There were giants in game theory. There are giants in game theory. But my experience was not one of standing on their shoulders or trying to. You will see why in a minute. That was all happening in the beginning of the 1980s, 1982, 1983. By 1985, some of the great and the good, the giants, were beginning to make some very grand claims about game theory. Not only did they manage, according to them, to model bargaining, but they could actually unify the social sciences. They could become what mathematics is to the natural sciences. And that is a claim that none of us can afford to ignore as social scientists, if the ones who actually make that claim win Nobel Prizes, like Reinhard Selden and John Harsanyi. Okay, now what is this grand claim based on? My hypothesis here is that this grand claim is based on five major theories. Let me just list them and go through them. Right. In all the games we play with one another, whether they are pricing games between companies, negotiating games between Congress and the White House, what you're going to wear when you go to a party, that's a game, because it depends on what you think others are going to wear, and what they will wear depends on what they think you will wear. Even if you want to take it much, much further in the realm of political science, the constitution of the social contract can be thought of as a grand bargain between individuals and groups with disparate interests. And to the extent that it is a bargain, it is a social interaction. Now, the first theorem proves, and this is by John Nash in 1951, that all finite interactions, that is a big word, all finite interactions, among autonomous agents, have at least one rational solution, which can be discovered by means of game theory. So all decentralized decision making, where you have competition and you've got a multitude of firms competing against one another, this is a grand interaction, decentralized. They're autonomous agents, the firms, they decide individually their output strategy, their marketing strategy, their pricing strategy. Or if you have World Trade Organization negotiations or climate change negotiations, you have autonomous agents, they're interacting with each other. This is a powerful theorem, that there exists a rational solution. In other words, that it is potentially predictable what they will agree on, what the outcome will be of their autonomous, decentralized decisions. All negotiations, whether it's one-on-one, or end party, multi-party negotiations, have a unique bargaining solution that rational agents will converge to. Now that is, it's a dynamite of a claim. Because it also contains the theory of conflict. For if there exists a uniquely rational solution between, let's say, the negotiations between Congress and the White House, if conflict takes place, it must mean that at least one of the two sides was not rational. The third theorem is an extension of the first two theorems, and it simply states and proves mathematically, it's not just an argument, it's a mathematical theorem, that the first two theorems extend to dynamic settings. In other words, extend to interactions and bargains that are repeated over time. And therefore, it gives a great deal more power to the first two theorems. The fourth theorem extends the first two theorems in realms in which not everything is known in advance, where you may not know the precise preferences or character of your opponent. And that gives it even more power. And finally, the usual critique of economists' models is that they assume too much rationality. That you assume, you posit hyper computers in the place of individuals who have a capacity instantly to, you know, compute the value of alternative options without failure, without error, and they always home in on what is best for them, so what they do, what they want, and they want what they do. But in the 1980s, late 70s, early 80s, a spectacular theorem was proved by a couple of evolutionary biologists who were rediscovering game theory without realizing it. And effectively, that theorem shows that all these things obtain even if the agents are automata, mindless automata. So non-rationality is even required for this. If you take these five theorems together, what you end up with is the major claim, the grand claim that I began with, that game theory has the potential of unifying the social sciences and becoming effectively the language of the of real social sciences. Not hocus pocus sociologists and anthropologists. This is the language that you would hear in an economics department, not the LBJ school. Now let me go run through those five as simply but not simplistically as I can. The first theorem, remember, all non-cooperative interactions, competitive situations, have a solution. A rational solution, which we call an equilibrium. Let me give you an example. Suppose you have two players. One is in one room, the other is in another room. One chooses between the rows, let's call this player R, and the other one chooses from the columns. So this is Rachel and this is Charlie. Charlie chooses between C1, C2, C3, C4, Rachel between R1, R2, R3, R4. Okay, they don't cooperate, they do not communicate, they will only choose once, and that's it. And depending on what they choose, these are the dollars they get. Or let's to be more sophisticated from an economics point of view, units of utility satisfaction or preference satisfaction. Okay, so you assume that you only care about your own number, you maximize your own number, there's no social interaction between you and the other person, and you just maximize that number, because you pay off. So, look, there's a very nice 100-1 there, there's a 0-4, there is a 5-12, 10-10. What will happen? What is the rational solution here? Well, the rational solution according to game theory is this one, 1-1. And the way you get to that is to send... Most of you have seen games of that sort, right? Let me explain it very simply. There is a logic of successively eliminating dominated strategies, bad strategies. So, Charlie knows that C3 will always be better than C4, depending on what Rachel would do. You can see that because 20 is bigger than 10. The second number, by the way, is Charlie's payoff, and the first number is Rachel's payoff. So look at this, 20 is greater than 10, 0 is better than minus 1, 3 higher than 1, and 101 marginally better than 100. So why would Charlie ever choose C4 when C3 does better for him, whatever Rachel does, right? So let's get rid of C4. Now, let's unread of it. Just for a moment, I want to show you something. Rachel would choose R4 only if she had good cause to believe that Charlie would choose C4. Because look, if Charlie were to choose C4, Rachel, by choosing R4, she gets 100, which is better than 50, 20, 10. So R4 is a good reply to C4. But did we not just surmise that C4 will not be played if Charlie is rational? So if Rachel thinks that Charlie is rational, she will not expect him to play C4, and therefore she will not play R4, because R4 is only a good reply to C4. And you can work this out. I've constructed this game in such a way that once you knock out R4, once Charlie believes that Rachel knows that he's rational, and therefore she will not expect him to play C4, he will work out that she's never going to play R4, in which case he will not play C1. And if Rachel has anticipated all these clever thoughts on Charlie's behalf, about her clever thoughts about Charlie, then she would know that since Charlie is not expecting her to expect him to choose C1, she will never choose R1, and then he will never choose C3, and she will not respond by R3, and that leaves us only with one possible outcome. And this is the Nash equilibrium, which made John Nash such a beautiful mind. A Nash equilibrium is nothing more than a set of mutually reinforcing best replies. Now, of course, it's collectively catastrophic. Because if they had chosen R4 or C4, they would each have gotten 100 points of satisfaction more. So the Nash equilibrium is not, has nothing to do with our collective interest. What it has to do is with individually rational behavior, given infinite mutual self-respect for the other person's capacity to work out what's in his interest, given your own actions. So this is the same game. And let me just point out that the unique property of this outcome here, the Nash equilibrium, is that to come about, Rachel has to play R2, and Charlie has to play C2. And notice that R2 is the best applied to C2. So if you know, if you're Rachel, you know that Charlie would choose C2. 1 is better than minus 1, 0 or minus 1. So R2 is your best reply. And similarly, C2 is Charlie's best reply for Rachel's R2. Because notice that if you're Charlie and you think that R2 will be played, you have a choice between 1, minus 1, 0, minus 1. 1 is best. So that's why you have a set of mutually best replies. My strategy is the best reply to yours and yours to mine. That is the notion of equilibrium and of the rational solution. And if it happens to be a collectively catastrophic decision, as in the prisoner's dilemma, as in what's happening now probably between the White House and Congress, well, what can we do? This is what you get when you have a game which is designed in such a way as to give rise to a bad outcome. But it's not an outcome that either of them will regret, given what the other will do. So it's a set of strategies that confirm the beliefs that motivated them. And then therefore you get locked into. That's the concept of equilibrium. It is not the theorem. That concept we knew before Nash. We knew it from John von Neumann from the 1920s, who had actually devised all that. What John Nash did, and therefore propelled game theory from a minor mathematical technique to a theory that claims to be unifying the social sciences, is to prove as a theorem that there exists at least one such equilibrium in every possible interaction, as long as the set of strategies is bounded. It can be infinite, but it has to be bounded. And it moves human endeavors. The set of strategies is infinite. And agents are laboring under a mutual self-respect of each other's rationality, what we call commonly known instrumental rationality. If you assume these things, and it's not too difficult to assume them, then even interactions that we have not even thought of possess a rational solution. That's a very powerful claim. Now, whenever you come up against these kinds of theorems, there are three possible critiques you can utilize. The first one is a normative critique, a moral critique. Rationality, according to the vast majority of philosophers who ever lived, is a lot more than an incapacity to resist a net utility claim. This is probably how cats operate, judging by my cat. When it has a net utility gain, it goes for it and has no capacity for self-restraint. But Immanuel Kant, for instance, would argue that what really differentiates us from animals is our capacity to question our motives and to argue from the perspective of reason and the kind of reason which transcends instrumentalities. So this is a kind of ethical, moral, philosophical critique. A second kind of critique is an empirical critique, a predictive critique, saying that, you know what, real people don't like that. And we're not good at calculating, which is perfectly true. Mind you, game theorists don't have a problem with this. They say, yes, that's fine. We are creating a theory of how people would behave if they were fully rational, and then we assume that as they interact with one another more often, and they become more experienced at interacting with one another, in the marketplace, in negotiations and so on, their behavior tends to that. So this is the ideal. Huh? This is that admission has a sting in its tail. And finally, what I call immanent criticism, which is to say, okay, look, I'm going to make neither of these critiques. I'm going to take your assumptions as for granted. And I'm going to investigate seriously whether your theorems are correct, whether you can actually derive what you claim to be deriving from your own assumptions. I'm not going to challenge your assumptions. This was, as a PhD student, that was the critique I wanted to adopt. For a very simple reason. If you adopt these critiques, you're not taking seriously. They shrug their shoulders, your supervisors, the profession, they say, fine, you don't like our axioms? Go to the sociology department where they agree with you. But we're economists, we want to assume that, we want to find out what will happen in a world populated by rational agents, we really don't care about what Kant or Hegel had to say about rationality. So, the only way of getting through to these people is by saying, okay, fine, I'll take your assumptions as given, but will you please allow me to investigate whether mathematically what you're saying makes sense? And then, of course, they can't deny it. Now, speaking of normative critiques, in order to give it a little bit more substance to it, let me give you a particular example of the kind of games that we have investigated under laboratory conditions. Suppose you put N people, it could be 10 people, 20 people, 5 people, doesn't matter what, in an experimental setting. So you segregate them, each one of them sits behind a computer, and they can't see each other, they can't talk to one another, and you ask them to make a very simple choice. What you say to them is, okay, I'm giving you $10 each, and a choice. Keep it, or put it in a common purse. Once everybody has chosen, what I will do as an experimenter is I will take the common purse and double it, and then distribute it equally amongst the N people. That's a public good game, right? So the social optimum here is for everybody to contribute their $10 to the common purse. That is doubled, then it is distributed, and everybody ends up with $20, and they leave the room. The Nash equilibrium is that no one is going to contribute. It's a prisoner's dilemma. If it's a free rider's problem, you're better off. If the others don't contribute, you shouldn't contribute. If the others don't contribute, do contribute, again, you shouldn't contribute, because you're going to get double what they put in, as well as your own 10. So this is the standard prisoner's dilemma. Now, this is what we teach in economics as the result of rational thinking. My good friend and colleague from the University of East Anglia, Martin Hollis, the philosopher, some of you may have heard of him, stood up in the middle of a seminar when a prominent game theorist was presenting this kind of talk, and he accused him of scandalizing the students and of effectively undermining thousands of years of moral philosophy and the conception of reason, which allowed us to rise above the other animals. He and I devised a little experiment. Not a controlled experiment, not one that we could publish, not one that we were interested in publishing. We gave our students a simple tale, and we asked them to respond within 3 minutes on a piece of paper. The tale goes as follows. Mary attends her mother's funeral. There she spots a handsome man and develops an urge to talk to him with a view to asking him out. However, as the funeral comes to a close, the handsome man disappears before Mary gets a chance to talk to him. That night, Mary murders her sister. Why did she do it? Students have 3 minutes to answer on a piece of paper. We asked students who had been instructed in microeconomics and game theory, and students who were not. Of 173 game theory students asked, 124 asked to see the handsome man again, because he would attend that funeral too, wouldn't he? Of the 564 non-game theory students asked, only 32 answered similarly. Our conclusion, which of course we can't prove beyond reasonable doubt, is not that these students were less intelligent. We controlled for their test results. We controlled for, they were engineers, they were lawyers. They were not laggards intellectually, right? Our conclusion is that some answers like this one are not ones that come naturally to your mind if you have a modicum of moral character. And game theory, and education in game theory and standard economics is detrimental to students' character. There is no doubt about that. The predictive critique, you know, I mean, that we're not as rational as economists assume, but I will ignore that. Now, let's go to the second theorem. The second theorem, let me remind you, proves, in a particular way, of course, that we need to interrogate, that any bargaining situation possesses one and only one rational agreement. Now, I've been dealing with this now for almost 30 years, but every time I speak those words, I'm struck by the audacity of such a claim. Imagine, every bargaining situation, anywhere in the world, amongst anyone, comes equipped with one potential rational agreement. Then the question, of course, is, will the negotiators be sufficiently rational to get to it? Now, I'm going to give you a sketch of the proof. The thing with game theory is that it is, unlike physics, unlike mathematics, where all the elements of the proof, every single one, is within the published papers. In economics and in game theory, that is not so. It took me years to get to the bottom of Nash's proof. I read it again and again and again, but to come to the description that I'm going to give you now, to the presentation that I'm going to give you now, it took me about 12 years of serious, constant attempts to get to the bottom of it. And the reason is that there are hidden axioms in there which you have to work out by yourself. And spectacularly, the rest of the profession are not interested in discovering. But I'll come back to that later. Okay, now, let's imagine the simplest possible bargaining protocol by which I'm going to present to you the gist of this theory. Imagine you have two people bargaining. There is a pie of size one, to make it simple. It could be $1 million, it could be one cake, whatever. And it's a question of how they're going to split it amongst themselves. Let's say that Anne begins first and proposes a division. X1 is, let's say it's 0.6, that is, she's proposing that she keeps 60% of the pie. And she's offering 0.4, 40% to Bill. Bill immediately, during the same round, the first round of negotiations, has a choice between accepting, in which case the bargain process ends, there is agreement, or rejecting. This is very stylized in order to keep it as simple as possible. If he rejects Anne's offer, he must counter-offer another division. He say, no, you're not getting X1, you'll get Y1, and I'll get 1 minus 1, Y1. Now, obviously, Y1 must be less than X1. He must be offering her less than what she's demanding, otherwise there's no sense. We're assuming that each one of them is trying to maximize their own share. And he also, in order to have to back up this rejection of her offer and his own counter-offer with a modicum of credibility, let's say that we give Bill the opportunity of selecting on his computer a probability 1 minus P1 that the whole thing will blow up and there will be no agreement. You can imagine Obama and the Republicans, right? Imagine that every time somebody makes an offer, like today I just heard there was an offer, that Obama can counter-offer something and also write on a piece of paper a number between 0 and 1, which is the probability that there's going to be a default. And that they will not find an agreement. Okay, and then the computer decides, randomizes on the basis of that 1 minus P1 and decides whether there will be another round or whether the whole thing will blow up. If there is another round, and A accepts, sorry, that's not right. If A accepts, it finishes there. If she doesn't accept, then the computer randomizes with this probability. If the randomization does not blow up this negotiation, then Anne gets an opportunity to counteroffer and set her own probability of conflict, just determine it. And so on and so forth, and let's say that then you can have rounds 3, 4 ad infinitum. Okay. Now, we're getting deep into Nash's disturbed mind here. how he proved his theorem that every negotiation has at least one, or not at least one, precisely one rational agreement. Okay, let me define this. By the way, I have to warn you once again, you won't find this in Nash's own narrative. This is my narrative. These are my own definitions by which I try to make sense of that theorem for myself, primarily. Okay, suppose that round T, Anne demands XT and offers Bill 1 minus XT. I say a rejection by Bill, followed by a counterproposal and a threat of conflict, is credible if only Bill can show, can have a good argument, a rational argument, as to why he expects a net gain from this rejection. Because if he can't show that, then his rejection cannot be credible. Anne will not believe it. And she has no reason further to back down, or to back down at all. Now, this is the algebra behind that. I'm not going to bother you with that. Similarly, A's rejection of B's offer must come hand in hand with the prospect of a net utility gain by Anne if her rejection of Bill's offer is to be credible. Okay, that's the definition of what credible rejection of offers means. Now, consider some agreement where, you know, I get 55% and you get the rest. Let's call it Z. Suppose that Anne offers Z to B. B can credibly reject that agreement, and at the same time, Anne can credibly reject any such rejection. That is, we have reason, Anne has a reason to fear B's rejection because it is credible, and B has a reason to fear Anne's rejection because his rejection is credible. Right? That I call an equilibrium of fear. I have reason to fear that you will reject my offer with good, rational reasons, and you have exactly the same fear that I can do the same thing. All right? Now, that's just the definition. So, Z is an equilibrium of fear agreement. Nash's remarkable theorem is he's proved that there exists one agreement between Anne getting all the pie and Anne getting none of the pie through the gamut of all those possible agreements. Of all those possible agreements, only one constitutes an equilibrium of fear. In other words, it is the only conceivable point at which their fear will balance out and at which point they will concede one another. Let me go very quickly through the remaining three theories, because remember there were five that substantiated the claim that game theory unifies the social sciences. We've covered the main two, now we're going quickly to cover the other ones. The first, theorem three, is that the two theorems extend to dynamic theory when you have time involved, when you have repetition, when I do something, you observe what I do, and then you respond, then I observe to what you do, and then you respond. Dynamic theory. That's very important to introduce time, the time element, not just logical time, but actual historical time. Now, suppose that a very simple game, let's say that we place seven $1,000 bills on the table, and we have Anne and Bill, and we say to them, help yourselves. But the rules are very simple. You take turns. Anne comes to the table first, and then Bill comes to the table, and then Anne comes to the table. But every time somebody visits the table, can only take either one of these bills or two. If the person who comes to the table takes only one, the game continues. The other person can come and help himself or herself to one. The moment one of them picks up two of these $1,000 bills, the game ends, and we take the rest and leave. Okay? So this is a sequential game. There's dynamics. It is clear that the social optimum here is that Anne comes, picks up one, then Bill comes, picks up one, then Anne comes, and then there are no bins left on the table. They have distributed them amongst themselves. But the Nash equilibrium, which is called a subgame perfect Nash equilibrium, you know, we have amazingly complicated terms by which to confuse the mind of the young. This is a Nash equilibrium that applies not to a static situation, but to a dynamic sequence of choices, of strategic choices. the idea here is through backward induction that Anne will think, okay, now, I'm going to come into the table first. I'm going to pick up one bill. Should I pick up one or two? If I pick up two, that's it. The remaining five will be lost to both of us. So she really wants to know if she gives Bill a chance to play. If she does, in other words, she only picks up one of these bills. Is he going to give her a chance to play again? Or will he pick up two? And then she ends up only with one. In which case, it would be optimal for her to pick up two right at the outset and the help, to help the remaining five. So she thinks, okay, now, let's work it backwards. Suppose that there are two bills on the table. The person who steps up is going to pick up both. Why pick up one when you can pick up both? Which means that the person who steps up to the table just before that will know that and will do the same. And therefore, one bill will be wasted. And the person who steps up before that will know that and pick up two, so there will be two wasted. So the optimal strategy for me, Anne thinks, is to pick up two of these bills and end the game. This is, if you want, another failure of collective rationality at the hands or in the hands of private utility maximization, a kind of free rider problem in a dynamic setting. So by means of such examples, game theorists press their case that their first two theorems extend to dynamic settings. And they also try to argue that they extend beautifully when not everybody knows everything about their opponent. See, one of the arguments that Martin Hollis, Bob Sarton, and myself, three people from the University of East Anglia who were working on these things in the 80s, canvassed against standard game theory, especially the previous example, remember the seven notes, was, hang on a second. Okay. The theory says that Anne should step up and pick up only one. And we have common knowledge of rationality. So Bill knows that she's rational. And Anne knows that he knows that. Why can't Anne ask a subversive question to herself? And the subversive question is the following. He knows I'm rational, and he knows that I know that he knows that I know, and so on. So he knows another theory. Which means that he knows that I know that the rational decision here is to pick up only one bill. Sorry, to pick up two bills, right? So he expects me, to the extent that he's completely convinced of my rationality, my instrumental neoclassical rationality, that I'm going to pick up two of these and end the game. What if I do the opposite and choose only one bill? Is there no chance that he will question his theory that I am instrumentally rational? Because if there is a small probability that by subverting the theory which we commonly know, he will start wondering whether, in fact, I may have a momentary lapse of reason, or that I could be a righteous agent, a virtuous person, a Kantian who thinks that it is not right just to pick up two notes, kill off the game, create all this waste, and not to follow the categorical imperative of doing unto others what you would like to be done to you. Now, suppose that by subverting the theory, I create a small subjective probability belief in Bill's mind. That peak can be 0 point something. That I am not a game theoretical agent. In that case, Bill may think, hang on a second, if she's the kind of person that does the right thing, yeah, well, why don't I pick up only one when I visit the table, give her an opportunity to come back and pick up only one, and then next time I come around, then I pick up two. That way I end up with $3,000 instead of $2,000. So cunning Anne, who is not a righteous Kantian agent, thinking, what if I go against the roots of game theory and instill sufficient doubt about my game theoretical expertise in Bill's mind, that may give me more a higher payoff. And so this is an economist's delight, this kind of thinking. It's highly instrumentally rational. It's not even Kantian. The response they give is, they like that. When we criticized game theory for not taking into consideration the possibility that rational agents will subvert the theory which supposedly governs their behavior, they liked it, but they wanted to engulf it in their own theoretical models. So they said, okay, suppose Anne is righteous with probability P. Is that what you're telling us? Okay. Let us assume that the probability of righteousness is commonly known amongst all non-righteous players. And the probability of bluffing, that of pretending to be righteous when you're not, is also commonly known. Then we can recast our Nash equilibrium with probabilities in it. So we make the model more mathematically complex. We publish more papers in Econometrica. We get promoted. We get higher payoffs ourselves. And we have also incorporated your subversive logic within. But what is essential here is that the only way of doing it is by assuming common knowledge of probabilities. And that is, as I will say a bit later, an epistemological minefield. But let me go a bit further. This is the fifth theorem which adds particularly weight to game theory, has enhanced its discursive power no end. Because one of the, I'm repeating myself a little bit here, but it doesn't matter. The first objection by students when they encounter economic models, or game theoretical models even more, is to say, hang on, folks. I mean, your assumptions about rationality and about the complete conviction that I have that you're a supercomputer and that you know that I know that you're a supercomputer, that all makes no sense. I mean, that's not how the world works. Now, the fifth theorem showed that everything I've told you so far holds even when the agents are particularly stupid. I mean, so stupid that they are not human anymore. They are automata. They are genes, they are computer programs, algorithms, whatever. So what happens here is that we lose the individual. The individual doesn't exist anymore. The liberal individual has gone. And it is replaced by strategies. So strategies develop a life of their own in precisely the same way that in Richard Dawkins' awful book, The Selfish Gene, an anthropomorphism imputed human intentions onto genes. So what you're studying now is not the strategy of persons or firms. You are studying the evolution of particular strategies. Each one of them has a Darwinian penchant for domination. So what happens is, as in a Darwinian process, you have adaptational strategies and you have mutations. So effectively, there are two mechanisms that are posited here. One is an adaptation mechanism, what biologists refer to as a replicator dynamic, and that has a tendency to homogenize and spread the successful strategies around. Okay? And you can find elements of that even in David Hume's Treatise of Human Nature, the idea that morality is established through an evolutionary process whereby habits form, and then habits create normative expectations, and then when they create normative expectations, then you have motives, moral motives amongst people that solidify the conventions that have evolved. So this is a kind of adaptation mechanism that we are talking about. But at the same time, there's always another mechanism underneath that throws up randomly mutations. So we all establish a certain code of conduct. Somebody goes a bit mad for a moment or is a bit of a misfit and behaves differently. If his or her strategy proves to be more successful at achieving its capacity to replicate itself because of changes in the environment, social changes, whatever, then that one acquires an evolutionary advantage, and in pure Darwinian terms, it causes a shift in the adaptation mechanism. Now, the amazing thing about this theorem, the fundamental theorem of evolutionary game theory, which is due to a guy called Price, a very quirky Englishman,
is that he proved that every evolutionary equilibrium, when you have no individuals, no rational liberal individuals, or rational individuals emanating from liberal individualism, every evolutionary equilibrium is consistent with the Nash equilibrium, and even more significantly, the opposite does not hold. So a lot of inferior Nash equilibria are discarded because evolution does not support them. So game theory says, look how, what kind of progress we've made. We showed that there are solutions, Nash equilibria, in all sorts of interactions, and now by adopting your criticism of us, namely that people are not really rational, we have narrowed down the set of possibilities. So our science is becoming more accurate in predicting outcomes when we incorporate your criticism. And no, there's no greater morale boosting experience for any scientist, for any theorist, than to show that the incorporation of the criticisms of the opposition strengthen rather than weaken the theory. Right, so what's wrong with game theory? This is the imminent criticism which I began investing in from the moment I encountered all that. Because I have to tell you, again, now talking to you as a through the memories of being a young graduate student, two graduate students, when I was reading all that, firstly, I didn't understand it precisely. And very soon I realized, to my relief, that it wasn't because I was not as clever as my professors, it's just that they didn't understand it very much either. And the reason why they couldn't understand it was because of all the hidden assumptions that I had to spend at least a decade discovering for myself. And secondly, interwoven with this idea that there are hidden assumptions in there, I was very skeptical of all this. But it was my decision not to challenge the assumptions and to see whether they can actually get to those results, or what was it that they had to do? What assumptions did they have to incorporate in the theory, which were missing or hidden, in order to be able to prove properly their theorems? That's an internal critique or imminent criticism. Now, the first thing that one spots, if one looks carefully at game theory, is the ubiquitous presence of indeterminacy. Now, this is a game that Obama is playing with Congress. It's a kind of chicken game. You can play aggressively. You both play aggressively, you have a negative outcome, a default. If they both refrain from this kind of activity, then there's a positive outcome for both. But what undermines a nice little acquiescent solution is that the two Nash equilibria are here. So this is what I mean by indeterminacy, multiple equilibria. If you know that the other side will attack, you're better off refraining. Zero is better than minus two. And if the other side knows you will refrain, he's better off attacking. So this is a self-mutually reinforcing Nash equilibrium, but so is that. Which means that in this case, game theory cannot tell you what will happen. So this is one of the problems that game theorists have to accept. They try various tricks in order to say, well, in that case, there's a third equilibrium in mixed strategies, which doesn't tell you what to do, but gives you what probability you should use with which to choose either attack or refrain. But then, of course, the debate goes one level ahead. Then you can say, okay, but those probabilities, while you can show that if each one of us uses these mixed strategies to choose between the aggressive and the acquiescent strategies, what you can't show is that I have any motive to use them. If I use them and my opponent used them, we would be in an equilibrium, but why should we want to use them? So there is no intentional theory, a theory of intentionality that can support this kind of escape from indeterminacy. And the more realistic the settings where we try to apply game theory, the more radical indeterminacy becomes. The second problem is that some of the equilibria are utterly unconvincing. Let me give you a very simple example here. Okay? Again, three strategies to choose from. R1, R2, R3, C1, C2, C3. Right? Now, look, if we choose the same strategy, the first strategy, each one of us, R1, C1, we get 1 and 1. R2, C2, 1 and 1. R3, C3, 1 and 1. So the best outcome here, right, is to coordinate. If I choose my first strategy, for you to choose your first strategy. If I choose my second strategy, you choose your second strategy, and so on. I created a little model in order to convince my game theoretical colleagues that there are occasions when I don't care whether there is a Nash equilibrium, I wouldn't follow it. Because here, what I would do, I don't know about you, I would choose R3 if I were Rachel. Because that way, whatever you do, I get one. Right? Whereas if I choose R1, there's a chance of getting minus 100. Why would I want to do that? The maximum I can win here is one unit, right? If I choose R3, I'm guaranteed that one unit without having the threat, by the way, the threat of minus 100. There is, this should be minus 1, 2 as well, minus 100 there. There's a minus missing there. But the Nash equilibrium here is this one. I won't go into it precisely, but let me just run you through the Nash's logic. Okay, why would you choose R3, Nash might ask me. Well, the answer is that I fear that if I choose R1, then a C3 will destroy me. I'll get minus 100, okay? So I would not choose R1, I will just choose R3. Yes, Nash says, but if that is a uniquely rational outcome choice, then Charlie, knowing that you will choose R3, is going to choose C2 to get 100. That's fine by me. No, it's not fine by you, says Nash. Because if you know you will choose C2, you're better off choosing R1 because you'll get 100. And then, of course, he's going to choose C1 because C1 is his best reply to R1, and you'll be locked up here. And when I say to him, I don't care, he says to me, well, I don't care. Because if you have an infinite degree of commonly known rationality, you should go to 1-1. So the point of this is to show to you that sometimes, even if there is a single equilibrium outcome, I don't see why even instrumental rationality should lead to it. This is one of the criticisms that I had to come up with, or I wanted to come up, and I did come up with, in order to shake the complete conviction of game theorists that they had pinned the whole thing down. Didn't work. Now, this is something that Jamie has heard of, heard me saying before a number of times. When John Nash took his bargaining solution to John von Neumann at Princeton in 1949, John von Neumann read it and said, "Oh, it's very interesting, young chap, but I think it's quite trivial. Ever since, John von Neumann has acquired the reputation of a grumpy old professor who was unwilling to recognize the genius of the young man. I don't think so. I think that John von Neumann was right. Because remember the proof, at least my presentation of the proof of Nash's theorem. What we said is, when a player rejects an offer and then threatens with particular probability of conflict, Nash implicitly assumed common knowledge of the probability of conflict. But what I can show, and I did in a paper that I published in 1999 or something, that this is intellectually, conceptually equivalent to assuming that in the fullness of time, if this bargaining process unfolds in time, you know precisely, you and I have common knowledge of when we will agree. Now, it's one thing to have more or less the same idea. It's quite another to have common knowledge of the moment. Imagine now Obama and the White House, Congress, having common knowledge of the moment when they will agree. Do you know what this means? It means that Obama knows the moment in time when they will agree, and knows that Congress knows that he knows precisely that moment, and that it agrees, that they will agree at that point. And that Obama knows that Congress knows that Obama knows that Congress knows that particular moment in time. If we knew that, then we can use backward induction and come to the present. If we know the duration of the conflict, why go through the conflict? That's why it was trivial. The uniqueness of the solution of Nash is predicated upon the assumption that we have common knowledge of P, which is the same thing as having common knowledge of the duration of the negotiations, of how long it will be before we reach an agreement. But that is to assume that which you are trying to prove. And therefore, von Neumann was right. It was a trivial solution. But let me skip all this because time is passing. I want to recap my internal critique, what I ended up publishing as my view on game theory, and my internal critique of it. Firstly, let me just read. You have a notion of what it means to be rational in a social setting, which begins with the assumption that you could determine one's motives independently of the social environment. This is a pretty impoverished notion of reason that the ancient Greeks, the German philosophers, the French philosophers, and certainly David Hume would not acknowledge. And then you're surprised that this impoverished notion of reason cannot shoulder the explanatory burden that you're trying to impose upon it or put upon its shoulders in your pursuit of solving your models. To solve your models, to say, okay, now this is an interaction, what is the solution? Which is what Nash tried to do. You need to have a radical absence of a motivated theory of errors. Players cannot be allowed to think subversive thoughts like ants. What if I do not behave according to the theory? Or you allow her to think those subversive acts only if you assume that her disobedience of the theory, her subversion of the theory, is common knowledge amongst everybody else. In which case, what kind of subversion is it? In its evolutionary guise, just like in biology, what my biologist friends tell me is that it makes perfect sense to presume uncorrelated mutations. That mutations of genes and so on are random, truly white noise. But to make that assumption in a social context is the equivalent of the end of politics as we know it. Because what is politics if it is not an attempt to correlate our mutations? What was the civil rights movement? It was an attempt to correlate disobedience, mutations. Attempts to subvert the existing order of things, the existing social norms, and to create new ones. And these were not random mutations at the individual level. The whole point of politics, and therefore of history, is to correlate them. To assume that these are not correlated is effectively to try to write a social science free of politics and history. And we come to what I think, yes?
You say that the correlation was, in fact, if it's led by one person, that they had a random permutation, and in fact the others responding with him are doing their best response. So it's not that they're also mutated, it's the fact that they're responding more quickly.
Is that what happened in the 1960s in the South?
One
person refused to move in a bus and the others immediately did what was maximizing their utility?
But even it doesn't have to be that the bus was the action, it could be that the discussion at the topic was someone else doing the action.
Okay.
So as opposed to never bringing it up beforehand, I decide to talk about it with somebody. Mm-hmm. And then they decide, oh, maybe I should best respond by also talking it with somebody. And then eventually the action becomes, let's do something about it.
Well, I should put what you're saying quite differently. If that is how the politics works, then there could never be any stable political order. Because if one person's stepping off the equilibrium path could destabilize the political order in that way, then you would never have any political order that's stable.
Well, only if there's a game. So it
Pardon?
Wouldn't necessarily be that one person's deviation always improves and everybody best responds. It could be that one person's deviation is just doesn't work at all, and so there could be stability for periods of time.
I have no doubt that there are highly unstable political orders where one person's deviation can destabilize it, and then everybody else simply adapts to that one person's deviation, which is what you're saying. But this is not how politics, at least this is not how my understanding works. So when you have radicals agitating, writing pamphlets, demonstrating, the whole point
is to try to convince others to mutate along with them in a way that will have a personal cost in the context of, you know, personal fitness unit maximization.
And so if others don't go along with it, then clearly it wasn't a best response, it's not a best strategy.
Well,
so then
this is a very interesting conversation.
That mutation is unsuccessful evolutionarily. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you think that history can be changed by the mutation of one person, then you're right. My understanding of history is that it takes many purposeful attempts to subvert the ongoing replicator dynamic at personal cost. If there is a chance that this replicator dynamic can be subverted. Now, what you're effectively telling me is that you accept the evolutionary game theory proposition. Okay. Yes.
I will comment on that. So, according to the economist's point of view, the first mutation was random. The first person who decided to
yes.
go against it
yes.
decided randomly, as opposed to coming up with ideas that were somehow, you know, part of a social political system.
Can I answer that? I think the right economic answer is that we don't care where these ideas come from, but from a statistical point of view, their emergence can be modeled as if it was white noise.
So it would have to be something that just really came ex nihilo, something really someone just had an idea that had never had any connection to
That's
anything
right.
in the world before.
It has to be completely random. In other words, there can be no build-up of. And remember, correlated mutations does not mean that when I do something and immediately you do it. It simply means that the probability that you will do what I do increases. Okay? Now that is banned from here. And you know why it's banned from here? Because you can't model it mathematically. It's very simple. Okay. So my conclusion, now I'm beginning to conclude. So I begin my concluding part of this talk by saying that game theorist models are either overdetermined or underdetermined. And unless you have very particular interesting cases like the prisoner's dilemma, the only way of closing them, of generating solutions for a very large set of these games, large enough to allow you to claim that game theory can unify the social sciences, is by means of what I call a sleight of hand, by introducing these axioms that I mentioned before, which I never stated, but which are always needed in order to close the models. Now, the interesting question is, why have so many brilliant minds gone along with this? Either you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and there has to be some other explanation, which can't be a conspiracy theory, by the way. It's not allowed to be. Observing game theorists at work, what I have seen with my own eyes is this a process of constantly elevating problems that have never been solved onto a plane of higher abstraction without solving them simply by complicating. And in the process, game theorists find themselves in a situation where they have to introduce less and less credible hidden axioms, mostly hidden, in order to solve their models. In the end, however abstract and complicated and sophisticated mathematically the model is, indeterminacy rears its head. So, more broadly, from a social science point of view, I think that game theory is the highest form of an attempt to explain the social world in terms of instrumental rationality. And in the end, of course, it reaps the harvest it has sown because, as I was saying earlier, the kind of rationality that it imputes is too impoverished, too flimsy, too brittle to be able to sustain this burden of explanation. To do the job that they have set themselves for, to do, game theorists must assume that instrumental reason has a monopoly of insights on how people behave when they are not instrumentally rational, when they reject being, when they are Kantian. They have to have a precise probabilistic, a probability density function regarding the behavior of those who are not rational in this manner. Otherwise, the models cannot be solved. And errors cannot be segregated from rational attempts to subvert logic. The result is a logical mess, which is bringing game theory to a halt these days. Let me put it differently. In the last 10 years, there hasn't been a single interesting game theoretical innovation. Those great five great theorems were completed by the 1980s. All we now have is endless recapitulation, endless applications. Some of the thoughts that game theory cannot fathom, cannot incorporate. I think that it overestimates our computing capacity and underestimates our capacity rationally to subvert our own theories of what is in our interest. It can't take into consideration what Camus said about us being the only creatures that we refuse to follow the rules which we have worked out are the ones that govern our behavior or ought to govern our behavior. And also, Hegel's point or insight that I can't ever be absolutely convinced of who I really am in isolation to the reflection of myself that I catch from looking at yourself, at you in the eye. The game theory strategy in response to all that is, as I said right at the beginning, is to argue that game theory, if you want to be a serious scientist of society, then you have to adopt game theory as the grammar, the syntax, and the mathematics. They construct exceptionally sophisticated and very interesting interactions. Very interesting interactions, very insightful interactions. But then they try to solve them. Then they try to extract, to close the models. And the only way of closing their models is by destroying all the sophistication through the hidden assumptions that they introduce from the back door. How do they manage to get away with it and maintain academic power? Well, I have a very simple proposition here, or actually observation. If you look at the most successful game theoretical models, they are the ones successful in the academy that either provide, when you say, okay, prove to me that you're a sophisticated social theorist who can tell me stories about the emergence of feminism, evolution of racist beliefs and the way that they're subverted through anti-racist action and so on and so forth. They can do that because they can construct very beautiful interactions that are very rich in their capacity to tell stories. But they will not close the model then. Because either they will give you this richness, or they will give you a closed model which doesn't have the richness. So in the final section of the paper, the richness goes away, and it is replaced by hidden axioms that sort of grind down the model into a pulp where there is a solution, but the sophistication has gone. Now, coming to the perspective of this meeting. Embarking on a career of game theory is like invading Russia. So you begin, like Napoleon or Hitler, with great enthusiasm and very rapid progress. But very soon you get bogged down in the snow and you end up with blood on the snow. I have encountered countless game theory graduate students who attempt to civilize Homo economicus. They try to introduce, for instance, psychological elements. A situation where your utility doesn't only depend on the outcome, but also depends on what you think the motivation behind your opponent was. And that creates fascinating psychological riddles And it truly civilizes home economics. Suddenly home economics is beginning to seem to have a soul in the sense that he cares not only about what he gets, but also about how he got it. Second order beliefs become important. So for instance, I may not want to do well in my exams, but if my professor thinks that I'm going to do well in my exams, that gives me an incentive not to disappoint him, and I get more utility from doing well in my exams, and then I may study more, but that gives the rise to the possibilities of self-fulfilling equilibria. If he has negative expectations of me in a kind of Keynesian micro-world, right, then I do what I was going to do anyway, which is not study and fail, and therefore I would confirm his low expectations of me, but that's all right with me because I've not disappointed him. But if he has high, so this is one equilibrium, and then there's an alternative equilibrium. So you have multiple equilibria, even if you have no game, really, because only one person acts, the student. So attempts to civilize homo economics lead to radical indeterminacy, to multiple equilibria, even if you have only one pair. This is an example of psychological game theory. And once you, so what happens is, you start invading Russia, you're full of excitement, you go to your supervisor, you say, look, I've introduced the second order beliefs in utility functions and I've civilized home economics. And your supervisor says, very good, carry on. After the first year of writing your models and working them out, you end up, of course, with radical indeterminacy and you have pages and pages and pages of potential equilibrium outcomes. So the answer is, of course, anything goes when you have multiple equilibria. It's like asking a meteorologist, what is the weather going to be tomorrow? And you say, well, my predictions are that it may rain, it may snow, there may be drought, it may be hot or cold. You say, okay, thank you so much. Right? So your supervisor says to you, this is all fine, my dear boy or girl, but can you narrow down your equilibria? Because this is unpublishable. All right? I mean, it's a very interesting, rich setting. You can tell wonderful stories, but what will it happen under fairly reasonable assumptions? And this is, in the end, a truly illiberal move. Because the only way you can close that model, you can only publish it, and you can only get your PhD if you close the model. And the only way you can close the model is by getting rid of that sophistication. You have to introduce axioms that are ironclad in the way that they impose, for instance, common knowledge of probabilities, of probabilistic beliefs about bluffing. And at that moment, you have a huge dilemma. Close it illicitly and lose its sophistication, or refuse to do so and be damned. You will never get published if you don't close your model. So, game theory refuses to engage the contradictions that are endogenously generated in its models. This is as a profession. This is what you find once you let's say that you take the plunge, you close your model, to finish your PhD, to submit it, to get inducted into the academy. And then you become part of a priesthood that refuses to engage with the contradictions that it endogenously generates. That does not mean that game theory is not interesting and useful. It is useful because it is the best exploration of the limits of trying to explain society by means of methodological individualism. Now, the most peculiar grand failure of game theory is that it fails in a manner which is inversely proportional to the discursive power of those who fail. To get to the bottom of what is wrong with the theorems of game theory, you need to have spent so many years of your life investing in it that it takes a heroic disposition to step back and say, I don't believe it. Relevance for the world we live in. This is another seminar that I could give. Behind every toxic derivative and every macroeconomic policy that brought us to the brink in 2008, you will find one of these Nash equilibria lurking within the models of financial engineering and the macroeconomic models that supported the policies that led to where we are. But that is another seminar. If you want to study game theory and to write a PhD thesis, I think that the only way of preparing you to yourself for what you're going to encounter is to read anthropology. Here's an extract from Evans Pritchard, 1937. The Azande, a tribe, see as well as we that the failure of their oracle to prophesy, truly, calls for explanation. But so entangled are they in mystical notions that they must make use of them to account for failure. The contradiction between experience and one mystical notion is explained by reference to other mystical notions. This is how game theory progresses, and unless you're prepared to play along with this priesthood's penchant for explaining failure by means of the intellectual tools that created it, you are always going to be, at best, a tolerated atheist in scripture school. Thank you.
Never get caught, because there's an option of stepping outside the system and the professor starts.